Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on this week's Relax Back UK show. Now, there are apps for absolutely everything nowadays. Previous listeners will know that I'm really quite interested in digital health. And the first topic is a way of using your smartphone to see if any changes in warts or skin lesions need further investigation.
If you have a malignant spot on your skin, in 95% of the cases, skin vision will diagnose it as such.
I chat with dermatologist Dr. Ivo Kodam about an app to help keep track of possible skin cancers. Then I visited the Everything Electric show in London and spoke to a few of the exhibitors. One, the motoring journalist Quentin Wilson, has been on the show before and he was lobbying to get government to get serious about electric vehicles.
So our job is to kind of get them to understand what's involved and what is going to happen to the UK if we don't do this, because it's a big industrial question. China, you know, America, Europe are forging ahead and here we are playing Little Britain, making a culture war between left and right. Do we like EVs or don't we like EVs? And we will miss out on this huge, huge investment if we don't do something about it.
So a very varied but fabulous show. So please do stay tuned. Thank you. So my first guest is Dr. Ivo Kodam. He's a dermatologist, and we spoke about skin cancers and a possible method to help spot them. My first question was, how many people get skin cancer and how serious can it be?
You want to know that for the UK, I suppose?
Well, in general terms, I mean, UK Health Radio is actually international, but okay. So, you know, whatever stats you got.
Well, worldwide, it's estimated that there are over 2 to 3 million cases of skin cancer yearly. But there's a lot of underestimation, we think, because not all countries report it well, and not all skin cancers are reported, especially the relative benign skin cancers are not reported very well. The melanomas, which are the most serious cases of skin cancers, are estimated to be about 325,000 on a yearly basis worldwide. And we think that estimation is quite okay, because melanomas are better reported than, for instance, basal cell carcinomas, which is the bulk of the skin cancers, but melanomas are far more serious. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands worldwide, and in the UK, there are about 17,500 melanomas diagnosed every year, and it's still rising.
Okay, and so in the case of melanoma, this is actually very serious, and unless something's done, quickly, quite likely to kill you.
Yeah, that's a little bit exaggerated, I think, because nowadays, when you diagnose it very early, then you have a very high probability of staying alive, like 99%. And the longer you wait with a mole that is changing, the worse the outcome gets. But if you're quick, then it's very well treatable.
Okay. So early detection, early diagnosis is the name of the game, what I'm keen to concentrate a little bit on now, particularly this product Skin Vision. So can you just kind of describe to us what this is?
Well, Skin Vision is an application you can use on your cellular phone, and I use it myself. So if you have a spot on your skin, which you're not very sure of whether or not it's okay, you can just use the Skin Vision app and it makes a kind of picture of the lesion, and then it's tested by the algorithm, and the algorithm will tell you whether or not the spot is okay, benign, or it's not benign. It's not making a diagnosis. It's just telling you whether it's safe to not do anything about it, or whether or not you should have it control it or go to a doctor. So it's not a diagnosis, but it gives you a chance of, is it okay or is it not okay? That is with a very high sensitivity. If you have a malignant spot on your skin, in 95% of the cases, skin vision will diagnose it as such.
All right, that's interesting, but it makes me think of a kind of rather simple question. I've got a mobile phone and it's got a camera on, but actually it's pretty old. I'm a bit tight. I don't like to change my mobile phone every year. So the camera on my phone is not nearly as good as like a newer phone. Will it work on my phone, which is a couple of years old?
Well, the algorithm needs a good picture, and if the picture is not okay, then it will tell you that it can't be assessed. And then there's a team of dermatologists. They will try to assess the lesion and give you an advice. So that's part of the job I do. I see pictures of lesions that have been a problem for the algorithm to assess it.
Okay.
But that can also... Yeah, sorry.
No, that's all right. I interrupted you. So you're the guest. Please continue.
Yeah, so if you your camera is not good enough and makes bad pictures, then the algorithm, of course, has problem with that. So, and the algorithm will show in your camera or in your phone if the picture is okay or not. And if it's not okay, it will tell you, and then you can still decide to send it to Skin Vision, and then it will be assessed by human eyes, like my eyes. And I'm also a kind of algorithm, because I've been looking at skin lesions for over 30 years.
Now, that's an interesting point, because I was going to ask, do doctors see the image? Because I'm a bit of a dinosaur, okay? I'm 57, and my nature would be a little more trusting of you, who's been doing it for 30 years, and maybe something on my phone, which has been around for a year or two. So am I just being a bit old-fashioned?
Yeah, I wouldn't judge it like that. but you must realize that this algorithm is fed by a lot of diagnoses. There are more than 100,000 diagnoses put into the algorithm, and it's updated every day, so it's getting better and better and better. And the human eye is probably in the long term less efficient than this algorithm.
And I suppose the algorithm doesn't get tired. I mean, even you at the end of the day might be a little more tired.
Yeah, probably.
At the start of the day.
Yeah, but there are already, for instance, if you go to a radiologist, chest x-rays are nowadays better assessed by a computer than a radiologist. And what you already told, a radiologist can be very tired at the end of the day, and he has seen 40 chest x-rays, and then he's tired and he misses something, and the algorithm is always fit. So I know what you mean, but there are a lot of advantages to algorithm, and it's getting improved every day, and that's a good thing. If it's like the chess computer, the first chess computers I could easily beat, but nowadays the chess computers can even beat the world champ champion chess. But that's the basically what it is. It learns and learns and learns, and it surpasses the master.
Yeah. Okay. So you're saying the algorithm. So is this kind of fueled by AI? Can you kind of explain? I'm a layman, all right? I'm not a computer person. I'm not a medical person. Can you sort of explain in terms that I might understand how the algorithm works and how it gets added to?
Yeah, well, that's a bit technical question because there are special technicians in the skin vision team, and they do that. They feed the algorithm every day, and every malignant diagnosis, for instance, is we try to get information from the patient, and we try to get the reports from the pathologist. So then you really know this was a melanoma, and that information is fed to the algorithm, and that's the reason why it's get better and better. Mm-hmm. Because he knows this picture is from 100% proven melanoma, and if you feed it every day with that information, it can far better assess the lesions, and yeah, and then the sensitivity goes up every year.
And so there'll be a database behind all this. So does Skin Vision have just its own database, or is there, behind it, is there a massive database? Like, for instance, in the UK, I'm sure the NHS has a database of these kind of photographs. So is it drawing on a massive database, or is it just a sort of a relatively small Skin Vision database?
As far as I know, it started with more over 130,000 cases, which are fed to the algorithm, and that's being adding up every day. So it's not a couple; it's more than 130,000 where they started with, and I'm not sure how much they're in now, but more than what they started with.
Okay, all right. So there's a lot of information for this thing to learn from and draw upon.
Yeah, and if you look 10 years further from now, then you can imagine how many will be added to the algorithm. And that's the best part of an algorithm. It's every year, like the chess computer, it's getting better and better and better and better.
Yeah, the
whole doctor is also getting better.
Yes, that's true. I mean, this algorithm, it will depend, I'm sure, because I don't know if there are competitors to Skin Vision, but you know, the one that has the most customers will have the best algorithm, won't they?
Yeah, probably, but you also have to do the right things with and the algorithm has to be fed well by the technicians. So it's not only the amount of data, but you also have to do it in a clever way.
Okay, all right.
But I think there are more companies working on in this field.
What I was getting at is if there could be one big database, it might be a better thing. But yeah, maybe not. It's not my world.
If you put everything together, yeah.
Yeah. Now, if someone uses the Skin Vision, they take a picture of a mole or something that looks a bit different on their skin. What's the process? They send it in, and what happens next?
What then happens that it is assessed by the algorithm, and a lot of lesions will be assessed immediately, and you get an answer in a minute. And then you get, for instance, you get an answer. There are no concerns about this lesion, and there's always a kind of disclaimer that you always have to take a look at it once in a while. But the easy cases, you get an answer immediately. Mm-hmm. But the difficult cases, you get an answer. We have to assess this by a dermatologist, and then it can take up to 2 days before you get an answer, and that answer can still be this is okay, you don't have to do anything with it, but it can also tell you you have to see a doctor with this lesion.
Right. So it says, right, this is important. You need to go and see a doctor today or tomorrow.
not today or tomorrow. Well, we make a difference. For instance, if it's a melanoma-like lesion, then there's a bit more stress on it to see a doctor, not in 6 months, but in within 2 or 4 weeks.
Right. And is there a kind of a follow-up? Will it in a couple of weeks' time, will it send a message saying, now, have you done what we suggested?
Yeah, there's a lot of follow-up, and you can also ask the Skin Vision app to give you a notice in 3 months or 6 months, and it's all you can show where it is, and then the app remembers where the spot is, and it helps you to follow up the lesion.
All right.
And you can send in a new picture in 3 months.
Okay, now that's really good, because kind of remembering what it looked like 3 months ago can be really difficult. You know, if
you're difficult, but that's remembered by the app.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. That sounds extremely useful.
Yeah, it's good for you.
Yeah. Now I people that have listened to this show before know that I always or very often ask people for data and proof, etc. So what other kind of published peer-reviewed type papers that talk about this this system? Are there such things, and say how wonderful it is or how well it works, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Now, they have been doing a lot of studies about this, of course, because it's necessary that people know that it's assessed and it's okay. So one study has been done by the Erasmus University Dermatological Department, and they checked it in I think over 6,000 patients, and they came to the conclusion that it was a 95% sensitivity. That means in 95% of the cases that it was a cancerous or precancerous condition, it was assessed like that by the algorithm.
Right.
So high sensitivity, and the specificity, that was 78%. So that means that if it's not precancerous or cancerous, then in about 80% of the cases, the algorithm says, well, you don't have to do anything with it. So that's one of the things that can be improved. That's the specificity. So that will probably be better in the next coming years.
Okay.
Or almost
All right.
sure be better.
Yeah, no,
so it's high sensitivity and quite high specificity, but the specificity can and must go up in the next years.
All right. I
it's validated in a clinic, in a good clinic in the Netherlands, and there are more studies.
I actually looked up one of the studies, and it must have been one possibly before that, because it looked at fewer people. It looked at 785 lesions. I don't know if that's 785 people, but you know, it was obviously a smaller type study. But when I looked at this, and it did lead me on to think about it's a question that is more of a general question, I suppose. But you can look at it sort of specifically to skin vision as well. If you like, it just took my interest that the conflict of interest statement. So the Department of Dermatology of the Erasmus MC Cancer Institute has got a grant from Skin Vision, and it goes on to say that some of the people that did the research are on the scientific advisory board of Skin Vision and have equity in the company. Now, for looking at this, first of all, you think, oh, actually that sounds a bit dodgy. Is that good science? But actually, I know full well that universities are very keen to hook up with industry, and academics are actually under quite a lot of pressure often from universities to hook up with industry and get sponsored by industry, which doesn't necessarily mean that the work is the research that's done is poor or skewed, but you know, potential is there. But you know, the fact that this paper talks about the conflict of interest statement and you know, and it's there, you know, that can only be a good thing. So I suppose there's a bigger question there, but have you got sort of comments or thoughts on that in general, and also specifically to skin vision?
Yeah, I understand what you mean, that there can be a conflict of interest. The only thing I know is that I know the professor of that university, and I know him as a really trustworthy person. So I'm 100% sure that the things that come out of that study is okay and unbiased. I'm that's the only thing I can say, but I understand that if you see that they are involved in skin vision, that's all. Yeah, you have to stay away from that if you can. But
I'll give you some background information and not really come clean. But you know, my wife is an academic, and she has to deal with questions like this on almost a daily basis. So
yeah, you know, no, that's true. And nowadays, if we go to a conference, always when somebody starts a lecture, then they have to disclose everything. And I think it's okay that you disclose it, because if you don't, then it's shady.
Yeah, no, you have to absolutely, yeah. And actually, academia is changing. It's harder to get money for research. So.
Yeah.
Scientists are under pressure.
It's unrestricted grants.
Yes, yes. It was an unrestricted grant. Yes, it says that in the conflict of interest. Interesting. So I was just, you know, in some ways, that's a bit of an aside to the main topic here. So let's get back to skin vision, of which I'm sure there are other similar systems around. But if people have noticed something on their skin that is a changing mole or a freckle or something like that, what's your advice? What should people do if they're thinking, oh, perhaps something like this might be useful?
Well, I think it's very useful to because the thing is that a lot of people the step to go to their doctor is much bigger than using this kind of app. So I think this will help us to diagnose skin cancer earlier. So it's not only this app, it's the doctors, but it can help patients, but it can also help doctors to decrease their workload, because I don't know how it is in UK, but in the Netherlands, there's a lot of pressure on the doctor's time. So if this can help to keep patients away from their practice because it's not necessary, then it's good for the whole health system.
Yeah, and there's massive pressure on GPs in the UK.
Yeah,
so things like this can only be useful. Actually, something which I didn't ask, which is quite an important question: how long does the process actually take? You know, if you've got the app loaded on your phone, and you take a picture, is it literally seconds?
Yeah, then you get an answer.
Yeah, or the actual submitting the information.
In a lot of cases, you get an answer within a minute.
Right.
But as I told you, if it's difficult, but sometimes it's difficult for the algorithm, and then it will tell you we need another assessment by a dermatologist, and then it takes longer, and you get a. I checked it myself yesterday, and there was a difficult lesion. I knew it was, and then I got a message back. So we can't assess it in a minute. You have to wait. And today I got a mail from Skin Vision, and they advised me to see a doctor with it.
Right.
I checked it for this interview, whether or not it worked, and it worked like that.
Yeah. So which is actually that. Yeah. So on the NHS in the UK, if you go, the whole process will take a lot longer than 2 days. You know, it could easily take a couple of weeks, I think, by the time you've seen a GP, seen a specialist, and he's seen the lesion, seen the thing you're worried about. That's going to be a lot longer than 2 days. So, you know, this is easy and fast.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of workload away from the GP. So I think a lot of people can benefit from it. And yeah, almost everyone benefits from it, I think, if you do it in the right way.
Yeah. Okay, so Ivo, how can people get hold of this app? Where can they find it and get it on their phone and start using it?
I'm not sure how it works in the UK, but in the Netherlands, it's a Skin Vision. You can load it from, I think, if you have an iPhone, from the App Store, and you can download it, the app, and then you have to fill out a form and then hope that your insurance company will allow you to use it, because that's the way in the Netherlands it goes, that a lot of insurers think this is worthwhile to do. Mm-hmm. And they let you use it, but it's not every insurer, it's not every patient. So some patients, if they want to use it, they have to pay for it.
Right. Well, so most people in the UK will be using the NHS. So I don't know if this is available on the NHS. Do you know?
No, I'm not aware of that.
My suspicion is it's not available on the NHS. So people in the UK would have to pay. Do you know how much it costs?
I think it's about 50 euros for 6 months, and then you can send in as many pictures as you want. Okay. So the follow up is also.
So it has a cost, but in the scheme of things, it's not crazily expensive.
It's not crazily expensive, and in the Netherlands there's a lot of insurers. They think, well, this is good for the patient, and maybe it's also good for the insurance that they don't go to the doctor immediately. So that's also a win-win situation, I think.
Yeah.
That's the reason why a lot of insurers reimburse it.
Yes, no, I understand. All right, look, very interesting, very useful. We are certainly moving into a whole digital world as far as many people's healthcare is concerned. And I think there's an awful lot of use and advantages to be gained from this kind of thing. And it, actually, the world of digital health does interest me enormously. And I really do think it can help a lot of people. But for now, Dr. Ivo, thank you so much for chatting. Very interesting.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
I recently went to the Everything Electric show in London and spoke with some of the exhibitors. I chatted with the motoring journalist Quentin Wilson at the Faircharge stand, and I asked him what the objective that they had of attending.
Well, we're here to help promote electric cars and widen the understanding among politicians, press and public. And we've launched today the little book of EV myths, Faircharge, in conjunction with the RAC, which is just 21 of the most embedded EV myths that you hear about. And we've rebutted them with factual accuracy using a myriad of global sources. So we're here, we've got a stand, and people are just coming up to us and asking us questions about EVs and electrification and what it means.
And at the stand, actually, there are lots of photos of you chatting to politicians. And I notice here, my MP is here, Daisy. What's the last name? I can't remember the last name.
Daisy,
is it Goodwin? I'm not sure. Anyway, MP for St Albans. Yeah. You're chatting to, and there's quite a few you've chatted to here.
We get interviewed an awful lot on television and in print, and we do drop-in sessions in the House of Lords and House of Commons and stuff like that, because, you know, we need to get politicians who make these decisions about electric vehicles and electric vehicle policy to understand what this is. It's a technological transition, and if you don't understand the technology involved and you don't drive an electric car, you are at a disadvantage. And lots and lots of politicians don't drive electric cars. So our job is to kind of get them to understand what's involved and what is going to happen to the UK if we don't do this, because it's a big industrial question. China, you know, America, Europe are forging ahead, and here we are playing Little Britain, making a culture war between left and right. Do we like EVs or don't we like EVs? And we will miss out on this huge, huge investment if we don't do something about it.
Okay, but you are having some success. I mean, you are talking to some big names here, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're looking at pictures of GB News and Talk TV, and I go up against Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg, and it's very important that we do talk in a wider area, because shows like this are great, but this is an echo chamber. People come here because they're kind of interested in electric cars. The people we need to talk to are the reasonable centrist people who think, I might buy an electric car next time, and are being put off by all the myths. So that's our role, to make sure that those people who are interested in the energy transition and do think that they want an electric car have the right information to make that decision.
That sounds like an excellent thing to do, and that's what you're doing at Fair Charge. What is the website for Fair Charge? I'm sure there is one with all this kind of info.
It's faircharge.co.uk. We're on Twitter at faircharge.uk, and we have a change.org petition as well, which you can sign up to. We've got 86,000 people have signed that petition as well, just to pressurise the government to do these simple things like putting electric car charging signs on motorways. You know, why is it so difficult? You can see I'm going off on one now, but, you know,
that's fine. Keep going.
I'm battling away the electric signs. You know, why, instead of having to take your litter home, tell us where the next EV charger is and how far it is and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's not that hard, is it?
No, it's not. And there are levers you can pull, like the VAT cut on public charging, and VAT on second-hand electric cars and new car, and just, you know, there's so much the government could do, but they're not.
Okay. Thank you so much for chatting. I am converted, so I will let you go and lobby a few politicians.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, right, I'm still at the show, and I've just had a test drive in a silence, I was going to say car, but actually, I'm talking to the gentleman who's running the stand here, and tell me, is it a car?
It's actually classed as a quadricycle. So it's a heavy quadricycle. The category of vehicle it's in, it's L7E category. Okay. So you get L1E all the way up to L7E. This is L7E. There's 90 kilometres an hour, about 54 miles per hour, up to 92 mile range, and it's the Silence SO4.
Okay. Well, in my test drive, I absolutely loved it. It felt like great fun. It did feel, I mean, it is small, you know, this is not a big vehicle, but what I loved about it, I'm quite tall and often I'm quite uncomfortable in little cars, but it was pretty comfy. Have other people kind of noted that?
We had a guy sit in a car just this morning, an hour ago. He was 6'10", and he's got long body, short legs. When I say short, I mean still longer than the average guy, but he's long bodied and his head just touched the headline, and he said he couldn't believe. We class the vehicle as it's small on the outside and large on the inside.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Now, I've got to ask, seeing as it is small and it does go pretty fast, I mean up to 54 miles an hour, you said, tell me a little about kind of the safety, you know, should you have a bit of a prang or a roll or hit some mud or whatever.
Okay, so these L category vehicles, with them being classed as a quadricycle, they don't have NCAP ratings in terms of crash testing. What? Because the whole vehicle is designed and built around a roll cage, so it's all tubular framing, bit like sat in a rally car really, but you just can't see all the steelwork. So they're still a very safe car, but they're very light as well. So in the event of an accident, you don't have crumple zones because it's wrapped around a roll cage. So you're more chance of bouncing off something because they're only 500 kilos as well. So yeah.
Okay. And the thing comes, it has a sister mode of transport, this Silence moped, motorbike. What would you call that?
Yeah, it's a moped. It's classed as an L3E, which is a 125cc equivalent to 68 miles per hour, about 80 mile range, fully automatic, and it shares the same batteries as the car. So we can sell a car and we can sell a bike without a battery. And if Mr. and Mrs. whoever want to take the bike out at a weekend, they just take a battery out of the car. So basically you share the battery, and that saves about £2,500 off the price of a bike.
And I saw you earlier actually taking the battery out of the car. So and this is just dead simple to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it's seconds. It's absolutely seconds to take a battery out. So you can charge the battery indoors, at work. You can leave the battery in the car and charge both batteries from the front. It's a normal 3-pin household socket, like with a kettle plug. We sell an inverter, so if you're lucky enough to charge, say, the battery at work, and you bring it home, you can take the battery out, you can plug the inverter on, and literally run household appliances off it. So we've got a battery and inverter on our stand, so we're running a fridge, we're running all of our show lights, card machines, everything off a battery.
Okay, so how long will that keep going, for the fridge and the lights and stuff?
It should last all 3 days.
On one charge?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 5.6 kilowatt battery, so you've got 11.2 kilowatts. So basically the car, it's got two hub motors and back wheels and both rear wheels. You have a battery that supplies the power to one wheel and another battery. So there's two batteries, two hub motors.
I love it. I really enjoyed the test drive. The whole thing is fantastic. If people are listening to this and thinking, right, this is kind of interesting, I want to find out more, I guess you're having a website. You got a website or something? What is it?
It's silenceuk.com.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed for chatting. I loved it. I'm at the Bow stand. And who am I chatting to?
This is Luke Robus, co-founder of Bow.
Okay, how many founders are there?
Three founders. So there's me, there's Oscar, and there's Harry.
All right. What do you do?
We make small electric vehicles, and we're focused on electric scooters.
All right. Now, this electric scooter I'm looking at is not like any electric scooter I've seen before. It looks incredibly cool. Was that part of your plan?
I would say from the beginning, we always loved the utility component of the electric scooter. We understood that it would bring people value in their lives, bring them time, freedom. But we were coming from the automotive world. So I was from Jaguar Land Rover. I was a designer there, and my co-founders had worked at Williams. So we really appreciated the qualities that came from the car world, from the transport world, and we really wanted to bring them through to the electric scooter world. So from the get-go, we wanted to design something that was desirable, something that people would love and care about, and also bring through those engineering qualities also from the car world.
Okay. All right, so if it's got some engineering qualities from the car world, you're saying it's different from other scooters. So tell us some of the differences.
Yeah, so to start with, the chassis, the way we built the vehicle, is entirely different. So this is the first monocoque style chassis in the sector. The standard approach to building an electric scooter is to have essentially three tubes that are welded together. And instead of
actually, maybe at this point we could do a little description, because it doesn't look like a regular scooter. That I can't see a single tube. It looks like it has kind of a chassis. A small chassis that you stand on, and there's not really a tube in sight, so it looks very, very, very different.
No, exactly this. So if you're looking at the image of it, you have this sort of silver boomerang, and this boomerang is built in much the same way as a monocoque, and that holds all of the internal components, whether that's the innovations that we'll likely touch on, like safe steer or lock and load. It's really about bringing the entire scooter together and it not being a collection of parts. So it's really about bringing the beauty with the functionality.
Okay, I like that design ethos. All right, you mentioned something about steering. Because one thing about scooters that kind of scares me sometimes, if you're in traffic, which actually, by the way, in the UK you shouldn't be, generally speaking, unless you've rented a scooter. But if you're in traffic and you want to tell people behind you which way you're going, maybe use a hand signal. So you take one hand off the steering bar. That all kind of scares me a little bit on a scooter. But you've got something to help with that.
Yeah, so we have the chassis. The chassis is wonderful. The geometry in the chassis is already great, which makes it a good riding experience. But then we have this new innovation. It's called Safe Steer. And Safe Steer basically stabilizes the scooter. It has a restorative force in the handling, which means that instead of the vehicle ever wanting to jackknife or like bump out, what happens is the steering goes back to center. And that means that you have more control, more confidence, and a better riding experience. And if you want to make a hand signal or you want to turn, be relaxed. This is what this...
Hit a pothole.
Yeah, hit a pothole, which unfortunately is all too common in the UK. But we wanted to bring innovations in that made your riding experience excellent.
So it has a tendency to want to go straight. Is that it?
Exactly that. It's you know, you've seen images or you see cyclists riding around whereby they're like no handing and all this kind of stuff. There's a natural restorative force in the wheel that we basically call it replicated with this innovation.
So could you in theory ride this thing without using your hands?
We would never advise that.
You've tried it, haven't you? I can tell.
You have tried it. People trying this, yeah. There's definitely content of people trying this.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So look, I'm going to have a test drive in a moment, and I have to say I'm really looking forward to it. I've just noticed one other thing I want to ask you about. That's the lighting. It seems to have good lighting.
Yeah, lighting was a huge component. Obviously, I spoke about our influences from the automotive world. We weren't looking at saying, okay, let's just tack on like some random light off the shelf. We built the lighting system in. We call it Light Halo. It's a 360-degree lighting system. It has a DRL style, so a bit like a car. And up front, on the top of the handlebars, you also have your forward-facing headlight, which is your high-power 800-lumen headlight. And that, you know, there's a bunch of little innovations in there, whether it's like the temperature-controlled element as well. So if it's like very hot outside, the lighting will adjust. There's a lot of things in here that we've thought about to make this an excellent, excellent experience.
When has it been launched in the UK?
Yeah, so launch is very exciting for us. It's actually coming up really soon. Production is now complete. All the R&D is complete. And we're now delivering units in June. So people who want to order this product can. They can go to bow.world, put their order in, and they'll be able to take delivery this summer. Very exciting.
Right, look, thank you very much indeed for chatting. I'm about to have a test drive, which I'm looking forward to, and I will report back after that.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Good, right, so I'm still at the Everything Electric show, and I'm talking to, well, I'm at the Boost stand, and I think I'm talking to the head honcho. What's your name?
Hello, I'm Nick from Boost, hello.
Okay, so you started Boost, did you? It's your baby?
Yep, started about 2 years ago. It was a COVID project that's turned into a whole company.
Okay, was it like a hobby that got out of control, possibly?
It possibly was, yes. I started off in a shed in my garden, buying some bits of motors and batteries off eBay, and then out of that created the system.
Okay, so just summarise what the system is. Essentially, you're electrifying existing bikes, is that right?
Yeah, so we take an existing normal-sized bike, or more recently a Brompton, and we add a motor onto the back wheel and a battery, and that's enough to electrify your bike.
Okay. So you provide to the customer a new back wheel with a motor in it.
Yes.
And the battery.
Absolutely, and we make sure that the motor wheel matches your existing bike, so to keep the look of it.
Yeah. So you can electrify pretty much any bike.
Certainly not any, and we're not going to start making grand claims, but definitely lots and lots of normal bikes that you would find we can electrify.
So I just tried out the Brompton, right. And so I hadn't ridden a Brompton before, so it was a bit different to a regular bike. But once I got used to that, I was surprised at how quickly kind of the motor kicks in, and how surprisingly it seems to be pretty fast.
Yep, well, the Brompton, it's pretty zippy. The whole Brompton experience is quite, you have fairly direct steering, and we've tried to keep the feeling of the bike feeling fun in the way that the motor kicks in. So yeah, very big fan of the way it's come out.
Okay, so, well, I think you've achieved that. Now, let me just ask you a little bit about your customers. What are people using, I suppose maybe specifically the Brompton, but the bikes in general for?
Yeah, I think there's a big silent majority in the whole world of bikes and cycling. The people that you hear about are the ones on expensive fancy bikes, but actually there are lots and lots of people who just use their bike to get to work or get to the shops, and we're trying to reach out to that silent majority just to make their use of their bike as easy as possible.
My feeling is that commuting is changing. Yes. And is going to change a lot more, and you know, with people like you providing this kind of event, it's not an event, it felt like an event for me just now, but this kind of product, I feel that this is going to gather pace.
I think so. I mean, I think in Germany last year there were more e-bikes sold than there were conventional bikes, and I think that's people using bikes more as a tool and more as it's a social thing, it's a commuting thing, it's fun, and so I think e-bikes will continue to just take on cars.
Yeah. Well, I certainly enjoyed trying out the Brompton. So many thanks for chatting.
Thank you very much.
One final thing. If people are interested in this, I've got to big you up a little bit. What's your website?
Boostbike.uk. We've also got a really friendly Facebook group, so feel free to join that.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much for chatting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were Dr. Ivor Codham, dermatologist, talking about skin vision, some of the exhibitors at the Everything Electric show, and of course, a big thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.